Welcome to this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I am George Hammond, the chairman of the Humanities Forum, which organized today's event. We also welcome our listening audience, both on the radio and online, and we invite everyone to visit us at www.commonwealthclub.org. It's my pleasure to introduce our speaker today, whom I know, Tom Merle, and I have a great story to tell you about Tom Merle. Mr. Merle came into this world at Children's Hospital during the war years. A fifth-generation San Franciscan, he is descended from Patrick Connor, who was in the posse that brought back the head of the famous desperado Joaquin Murieta. Connor went on to become general assigned by President Lincoln to take troops back to Salt Lake City to keep Brigham Young from siding with the South and to deal with the Indian question. How many knew that they were worried about the Mormons joining the South? That would be an unusual combination. Although, a form of slavery in each one at the time. Tom's great-grandfather, Bartley P. Oliver, was one of the 30 founding members of the Commonwealth Club, who also served as foreman of the grand jury that indicted Abe Roof for graft and corruption, leading to his doing time at San Quentin. That's not his grandfather. It's Roof, who went to the prison. Tom grew up in an Ozzie and Harriet household in Burlingame and then boarded during the week at Bellarmine Prep in San Jose. He received his bachelor's degree in philosophy from Georgetown and an MA in humanities from Chicago, winning a Woodrow Wilson scholarship. He pursued further graduate studies in political science and sociology at Berkeley, after which he taught at Grinnell College in Iowa. Career 1.0 in the real world was spent on the staffs of the National City Planners Association in Chicago and the Bay Area Council, where he developed policy positions on air and water quality, bay planning, and housing. For those of you who are familiar, that was a very big project that reversed the degradation of the bay. It's a very big and valuable project, and the Commonwealth Club just is doing the issue about the same issue for the future. Can we keep what we saved before? This led to project management positions with the land development divisions of Mobil and Chevron. He was the marketing manager of Redwood Shores while Marine World was still there, and then he managed master plan communities in Arizona and Colorado. He returned to California to oversee projects in Richmond, Vacaville, and Ontario for Chevron Land and Development. Both oil companies subsequently spun off their development operations, which led to Career 2.0, which has been spent in various facets of the wine business. Tom has served as executive director of Family Winemakers of California, and for the past decade has led tastings and tours of wine country. Some of you may have attended Tom's wine programs at the club earlier. He also served on this club's program committee and headed up the club forum, Let's Talk About It, since he believes strongly that members and guests should not just sit passively listening to an expert and possibly getting a question answered by and then filing out into the night. He now does this with meetup.com and the Mechanics Institute. He moderates an online forum devoted to discussions of Epicurus and Epicureanism and is the founder of the Epicurus Society, which leads us to tonight's topic, Epicurus, Ancient Wisdom for a Modern World. Tom, thank you very much. And Tom will be our presenter tonight, not our speaker.
Well, this is billed, I think, George, as a dialogue. So what we're going to do at the first half is present, because I'm not the speaker, the people in the videos will be the speakers, present some of the ideas of Epicurus. I smile because I think George even said Epicurus. Many people call him Epicurus. And as some of you know, Epicurus is the name of the Condé Nast website. And therein lies a tale. I'll just quickly give 30 seconds on that. When I left the land development business and went into the wine business, I did some writing, and I was retained. And this actually illustrates what we're going to talk about tonight. I was retained by one of the companies that did little magazines for conventioneers, sort of what's on in town. In this case, it was what's on in the wine country. This particular company was owned by Condé Nast, and the name of my club at that time was Epicurus. And lo and behold, about 3 months later, out popped Epicurus.com. How curious. And I thought, wait a minute, that's the name of my operation. But that was Condé Nast, and here was little Schlemiel Tom Merle And it illustrates the power, the importance of power in the real world versus what we're going to talk about tonight. This has not been rehearsed. This is kind of the dress rehearsal for tomorrow night, but there is no tomorrow night. I say that because I really thought it would be interesting to have, I think his first name is Alain de Botton, is his last name. Some of you may have seen him on TV. He's the English writer and philosopher himself, and he did a series on TV, probably for British television, that covered six or so philosophers, and he spent a half an hour on Epicurus. Did some of you see that? Well, then this will be this will be old stuff to you. But I thought it was what makes it interesting, I think, is that you're able to see a talking head, certainly, or a talking body, but he does travel over to Greece, among other places. Now, I say that this is a rehearsal, because when you bang down your gavel, you preceded George to do something. No. Let's just see. I think we can go forward. So there is Mr. Botton. I'm going to see if I can go a little larger. This will be slightly out of focus. And so what I'm going to do is, instead of showing the whole video, I've got actually four videos. I'm going to try to just go. I was going to try to make one master reel, but I don't have the expertise to do that. So we're going to see bits and pieces of various of these videos that I've brought to illustrate what George and I will have our, and the rest of you will have our dialogue about. So let's travel back here to the beginning and hope that this works. But we'll have Murphy's Law operating, so. Yeah, I think let's. We had it down. I guess it went back up, George.
Ever since ancient times, human beings have looked to philosophy for the secret of happiness. But few philosophers have come up with more suggestive or more relevant answers than one born on the Greek island of Samos.
Let me go back a little bit.
Ever since ancient times, human beings have looked to philosophy for the secret of happiness. But few philosophers have come up with more suggestive or more relevant answers than one born on the Greek island of Samos, off the coast of modern Turkey, 341 years before the birth of Christ. His name was Epicurus. Very little about him has survived. All of his books have been lost across the century.
Let me just, because we're still trying to figure out the lights, let me just see what. So you can gaze upon his visage.
Leaving his philosophy of happiness to be reconstructed from just a few fragments. Epicurus believed that we could all find a way to be happy. The problem was, quite simply, that we were looking in the wrong place.
So let's go up to 260. his work so much better at home.
But crucially, spent his time pointing out that happiness is in fact rather a tricky issue. And a philosopher might help you to find it more easily than a credit card ever could. That Epicurus was in favour of pleasure at all shocked many of his ancient Greek contemporaries. His philosophy became synonymous with a lotus-eating lifestyle. To this day, people who love luxurious eating and drinking can sometimes be described as Epicurean. In fact, that's a complete misunderstanding.
Epicurus said that pleasure was the most important thing in life, and yet, if we actually look at the way that he lived, it seemed he led far from a luxurious life. His house was very simple, his clothes were extremely basic, he always drank water rather than wine, he found fish much too expensive, and he was happy just eating meals with bread, vegetables, and a few olives. He once asked a friend, "Send me a pot of cheese so that I can have a feast whenever I like." These were the kinds of tastes of a man who described pleasure as the end of life. Epicurus took the idea of friendship very seriously, so seriously that he made an extremely radical innovation. When he came to Athens at 306 BC, at the age of 35, he bought a large house just outside the city of Athens, in this place here, which we called the Garden. Of course, at that time, it was rather beautiful, a bit more beautiful than it is now, where it seems to be a taxi graveyard. What he did was that he bought this house and asked a group of friends to move in with him. The house was quite large, so there was room enough for everyone to have their own quarters at the same time as coming together for meals and conversations in the common rooms of the house. What Epicurus was doing was picking up on a rather common sense point, which is that friends are a major source of happiness. But I think where he was distinctive was in his idea that in order to really benefit from friends, you had to see them not just occasionally, not just for the odd drink in a bar or the odd chat on the phone, but you had to live with these friends at all times, so they'd be your permanent companions. And I think that was his distinctive idea of happiness.
You wouldn't catch Epicurus devouring lunch on his own in a burger bar. He recommended that we try never even to eat a snack alone. Before you eat or drink anything, he said, consider carefully who you eat or drink with, rather than what you eat or drink. For feeding without a friend is the life of a lion or a wolf. The second thing Epicurus thought we needed to be happy was freedom. And in order to achieve it, he and his friends decided to leave Athens altogether. For them, to be free meant to be financially independent, economically self-sufficient, not answerable to horrible bosses for their income. So they resolved to leave city life and its competitive and gossipy atmosphere behind them once and for all.
So they left Athens and started what could best have been described as a commune. We must free ourselves from the prison of everyday life and politics, Epicurus wrote. And that's precisely what they did. The life was simple, but at least they enjoyed their freedom.
They didn't mind if they looked shabby or didn't have as much money as other people, because they were self-sufficient and had gained their independence from what other people thought. There was, in the financial sense, nothing to prove. Epicurus believed there was a third ingredient necessary for happiness, and that was an analysed life, by which he meant a life in which we take time off to reflect on our worries, to analyse what is troubling us. Our anxieties quickly diminish if we give ourselves time to think them through.
So that's a quick overview of the main points, and I'm going to spend a little time talking about what I think are the 10 takeaway items from Epicurus. But now we're going to go into another video, which I put in here because I think that as I said, it illustrates the kind of life that would be considered to be very Epicurean. And I went to two videos, one from 2020 and one from 60 Minutes. You may remember the one in 60 Minutes, well, you may remember them both, that they dealt with happiness. And they asked, where's the happiest place on the planet? And what place did they come up with? And it wasn't Nepal. Yes, it was Denmark. Denmark ranks number one in the world in several different surveys. And what I've tried to do here, and I apologize again, I couldn't put a master reel together. I've tried to pick commentary that does reinforce what makes Denmark so happy. Now, whether some of these principles can apply to the U.S. of A., it's very doubtful, although I do want to talk about what we could do if we tried to create a little bit of Denmark in San Francisco. So let's go to let's go to 2020. And hope that will come up.
And now a search for the happiest place on Earth. Disneyland claims that distinction, of course, but with all due respect, we wanted some place where the mice don't talk. Some place where real people face the daily grind, but are somehow nudged by their surroundings, their values, their government, into becoming the most content society on the planet. Well, we found it. But where it is and how they live might just surprise you.
When you imagine the happiest place on Earth, you might pick a spot with warm sand and soft breezes. A sun-kissed vineyard, perhaps, or a Mediterranean village. If asked to name the happiest country on Earth, you might choose this one. Land of the free, home of the brave. But when you let go of patriotic pride and travel brochure fantasy, when you use social science to rank 178 nations, a paradise like Fiji comes in more than 50 spots below Iceland. And for all their style and cuisine, France and Italy rank well below Canada. And while we may be number one in wealth and power, when it comes to happiness, the good old USA is number 23. How do we know? Well, for the past decade, social scientists and pollsters have given elaborate questionnaires to hundreds of thousands of people around the globe.
The answer you get is not only how they feel right now, but it's also about how they feel about their entire life.
Dan Buettner is the founder of Blue Zones, a project that studies happiness and longevity around the world. He says that if you mine all the databases of universities and research centers, you will find that the happiest place on Earth is Denmark.
I don't want to make this on Denmark per se, but I do. Well, this is not working well. You can be pondering these things.
The Danish word for tucked in, like a snug child.
You feel taken care of?
Yes.
Now, the politically incorrect truth is that Denmark has very little diversity. 9 in 10 are full-blooded Danes. 8 in 10 are Lutherans. Of course, happiness can exist in melting pots like America. But social scientists point out that higher taxes are easier to pay if you know the money is going to someone who looks and thinks like you. Those high taxes have another effect. Since a banker ends up taking home about as much as an artist, people don't choose careers based on income or status.
We see people quit their job because, no, I want to do something that I really, really like.
They have this thing called Jantelag, which essentially says that you're no better than anybody else. A garbage man can live in a middle-class neighborhood and hold his head high.
Well, let's find a go. Danish king, related to the royal houses of France and Spain.
This told the story of a fellow who, this young guy, is a carpenter's assistant.
And rarely discusses his lineage with anyone.
You couldn't ask for a greater opening line with the ladies than,
yeah,
I'm royalty. Don't you ever use that?
No, never.
Come on. Well, that's wasted, man. We
gotta... I don't know people say that. It's better if they found out themselves, and it works even better.
Joseph invited us over for a Danish tradition called hygge. Cozy, intimate, spontaneous gatherings with neighbors and family. Emotional insulation against the long winter. And hanging out with other Danes may just be their happiness secret. 92% belong to dancing clubs or singing clubs, even laughing club. Get a few people together who enjoy cold water swimming or model train building, and the government will pay for it. Yes, in Denmark, even friendship is subsidized. And this is what is called a post-consumerist society. People here have nice things, but shopping, consuming, it's not a priority.
I can't get over the fact that this is the smallest 7-Eleven sign on the planet. Even the advertising is self-effacing.
And with less emphasis on personal possessions and a strong social fabric, Danes also display an amazing level of trust in each other and their government.
Did you notice when you walked in the country, there was no long lines?
They didn't even check my passport.
Yeah.
Literally.
You look like a nice guy. Come on through.
Vegetable stands run on the honor system. Mothers leave babies in strollers, unattended outside cafes. And most bicycles are unlocked. And now that I think about it, the bicycle may be the best symbol of Danish happiness. They can all afford cars, but they choose bikes. Simple, economical, non-polluting machines that show no status and help keep people fit.
You have a good society that takes care of you. And mainly, people are good to each other. You can live your life, so it's a good place to be.
When we come back...
Then they go, I think they go on to Singapore. It's all regulations.
How happy is Singapore?
Very happy, actually. They rank like third, I think. So you have just the opposite. But I think the emphasis, the takeaway here is the emphasis on security, and I think the Singaporeans are both affluent and because of all those rules on behavior, are considered themselves very secure. So let's now then go over to Morley Safer. Is he still alive?
Sure.
Okay.
Tonight, we talk about happiness, that quirky, elusive emotion that the Declaration of Independence maintains we have every right to pursue. And man, do we pursue it. We're suckers for an endless stream of self-help books that promise a carefree existence for a mere $24.95. Television hucksters of every kind claim they have the key to nirvana. So the happiness business, at least, is one big smiley face.
This is a professor of at a university in southern Denmark.
Not as happy, so we tested different hypotheses.
So the result is blondes don't necessarily have more fun.
Exactly, so, but it doesn't hurt either.
After careful study, Dr. Christensen thinks he isolated the key to Danish anti-depression.
What we basically figured out that although the Danes were very happy with their life, when we looked at their expectations, they were pretty modest.
So, but
So the lowered expectations is also considered, I think, an Epicurean virtue.
I mean, the more powerful you are, the more unhappy you are. And the weaker you are, the happier you are.
Well, at least the pressure is off you, you know. And if you're doing pretty well and once in a while this outstanding, you're very happy about it. But if your starting point is that you should be outstanding, that's not good.
And then we'll finish up with a some young people talking about their country. They've just finished talking about how the Upper East Side of New York isn't one of the happiest places on the planet.
Side of New York.
The number one predictor of well-being is close friendships and close relationships in general, which includes, of course, family relationships. Much better predictor of well-being than affluence is.
Ben Shahar says Americans could learn a lot about happiness from the Danes.
It is about having realistic expectations. It's about not trying to fit in more than we can handle. We can't handle it all. We can't have it all, but we can have a lot.
You've lived in the States. You've visited the States.
Yes.
Would you live there?
It's got a grandness to it that you can never imagine here in Denmark because it's a much larger scale and the differences are much, much bigger. But I wouldn't want my children to grow up there.
Just describe for me the qualities that a successful person would have in this country.
Well, in order to see myself as a success, I want to be happy and have a lot of time with my family. I think that's very important to me. And the money is not that important.
It is more about the softer values, such as not being stressed and feeling passionate about what I'm doing. And maybe this job is not going to pay me a lot of money, but I'm going to love getting up and doing it every day.
Do you think that you can equate money with happiness?
No. If you have a sufficient amount of money, then I don't think it will make you a lot happier to get really rich. And we are already at a good level here in Denmark, so I don't think we'll be happier if we increase our wealth.
But these unmelancholy Danes, as laid back as they are, do not lack ambition.
I think that we have very high hopes, just like any other people do. We just don't get so disappointed when they don't. We don't see them through.
What would you advise Americans to do?
I have an advice. Don't depend too much on the American dream. Yeah. I think you might get disappointed.
I think I'll skip the fourth video. It's a wonderful video, but we'll go into what I view as the ten points for achieving the kind of happiness that Epicurus promotes, which is what the Greeks call ataraxia, or we would call contentment or tranquility, serenity. So let me see if that comes up. And let me go through it. So he spent quite a lot of time dealing with the issue of the gods and God. And what makes, I think, Epicureanism so profound is that it's neither atheistic nor is it agnostic. He is neither denying God. In fact, he spent a lot of time sort of acknowledging the gods, but that they existed in a realm somewhere else above empirical reality, and that humans never could make that contact. But he wasn't agnostic. It's not like he didn't know. It's just that they just made no difference in how we lead our lives, that we can get our pleasure without any reference to an afterlife, and that if anything, religion, particularly at the time Greece, and this was just after Alexander had conquered the world and there was tremendous turmoil in Greece, that you really can get the most out of life just by dealing with what's around you. And so the second point flows then from the first one, which is that, and like Denmark, that you would, instead of trying to save the world, that you come down to your own immediate environment, whereas, as I say there, Eric Fromm said, make a dent, make a difference with your neighborhood association, so that you would develop these ties of friendship with your immediate circle, and that creates what the social scientists call social capital. I have four there as disregard diversity, and we were talking a little earlier about, and that's not very politically correct, but it acknowledges that, like Denmark, insofar as you can create groups that share your outlook and share your perspective, share your values, that kind of pleasure that comes from friends will increase. Now, that's not to say it's all white America. It really means that anyone who acts in the way that you do or thinks in the way that you do can join your circle. Clearly, it is moving towards frugality and a simplification of life. Of course, the economy is making that somewhat easier these days. But that if insofar as we can simplify our life and move away from the collection of goods, the happier we'll be, the wiser we'll be. And so related to that is, again, control and choice. You should have a sense of what's going on in the world, cosmopolitanism, we might call it, but that you always act local. And the other video I had showed what was happening up in Sonoma. There's a tremendous effort in Sonoma to create a sense of that community, of go local, it's called. And they had one weekend where the citizens created 350 gardens. And I thought that was interesting, not just because it showed that spirit of the community garden, but Epicurus's philosophy was called a garden philosophy, and he met, as you heard on the video, outside of Athens in a garden. And that's what they're doing up Sonoma. They're doing it here in San Francisco, in many parts of San Francisco. In the write-up to George on the website, it said that take it easy philosophy, and I added Studs Terkel's expression, which he always used, you know, in Chicago on his radio show. He always said, you know, take it easy, but take it. So make sure you're able to create that environment around you. I put in there as number eight that you should always seek meaning. George and I have had a long discussion on Humanities West, and I maintain that much of what Humanities West does, in fact, what many groups do, present information, in this case about, say, the Medicis, and make no attempt to link it to what we're doing today, even though there are clearly lessons to be learned. So he and I can debate that subject, I'm sure. But there is so much irrelevant information. I would cite, for example, also information about outer space. What are we going to take away from that? What can we learn from the heavens? It's poetic, to be sure, but it's useless. I have number nine as because anyone disagree with that? The Commonwealth Club actually started its life, I don't know that anyone knows this, I learned this from reading my great-grandfather's 1908 bulletins from the Commonwealth Club, but it was first called the Agora Club, which is Greek for marketplace, where they would assemble in the Agora. You know, the Commonwealth Club has the name, the word club in it, and yet really it's a very fine speaker's bureau. Really not much different than Kepler's or Book Passage or City Arts and Lectures. And there's an opportunity to bridge and to bond with one another. And I don't see that happening as much. Certainly when I was involved, there was too much of the, as we said earlier, of attending, hearing someone, some luminary, and then going out into the night. So we used to have dinners. In fact, if anyone wants to continue to discuss more details, we could have dinner down the street at the Japanese restaurant if you wish. And finally, I put here Denmark, by the way, Denmark has 5.5 million people, and The Bay Area alone has about 7.5 million people in the nine-county area. And Denmark has the most favorable financial situation in the world. Its bonds and stocks have done better than any other country in the world. So that too makes for happiness. So maybe I'll stop there and we'll...
Okay. Thanks, Tom. So what I'd like to do is... Set on the light. What I'd like to do is to talk about some of the ideas about Epicurus. We talked about happiness a lot, but I'd like to talk about Epicurus' idea, or Epicurus' ideas. Yes, not curious. But basically, if you're talking about happiness, and happiness is your goal, and he's sort of listing the things that make him happy or that he suggests for being happy, but does he have a definition for happiness? Does he try to focus on it? Does he say, what is happiness? What is it, this, you know, because we want to have an idea about what we're looking for. I would rather have something concrete.
Well, it can be boiled down to, ideally, the elimination of pain and to the maximization of pleasure. Now, pain, he actually assumed that pain could sometimes be helpful for achieving greater pleasure. But it was a form of hedonism that, and he was particularly concerned about the mental confusion that leads to anxiety. So happiness is actually the elimination of mental distress. And once you achieve a kind of peacefulness with that around you, you've arrived at happiness.
And part of the program is eliminating distractions, eliminating some of the things that would cause you anxiety, essentially.
Yes, it was actually twofold. It was eliminating the distractions and the materialism, because once you go into the workday world, he was in favor of not participating in the political life. He was also anti-marriage because he felt that you made too many compromises, that you, at your back was usually exposed to the wiles of your spouse.
Then you know the vast majority.
But I just wanted the other side was that insofar as we're confused by what we see around us, if you can probe what it is that is disturbing you, that's causing confusion, that is ignorance, then you move further towards happiness.
All right. The politicians won't like finding out that they can't be happy. But let's
unlikely.
Unlikely. Yeah. But let's look at happiness. More abstractly than that. There's a wide variety of people who say that they're happy, for all wide variety of reasons. And it's not just about avoiding pain, and it's not just about by avoiding pain and having less anxiety that you now have some happiness. I think that part of the difficulty with this analysis and why it's confusing is because people don't have a clear idea, first place, what is that goal? What is happiness? What is it that's in common with all things? For those of a certain age, remember, you know, happiness is an ice cream cone, or what happiness is a warm puppy, you know, in your arms. Those kind of phrases are, this is something that if you have, you'll be happy. But, of course, they're never universal. Those are generalizations. I'm looking for something universal. I'm looking for something like, you know, happiness is the emotion caused by the fulfillment of desire.
What would be your definition of happiness?
That's what it is. Happiness is the emotion caused by the fulfillment of a desire. And the reason that we don't, you know, this applies to what Epicurus said as well. And what he's saying is change your desires. Move away from the ones that are causing you a lot of trouble, but it's fulfilling the desire that causes the happiness. So if you pick desires which are unfulfillable, you're going to have trouble. Okay? If you pick political, why he said move away from the political is if you... Your desire as a politician, maybe I want to be president, I want to be senator. You know, we have a couple of people spending their entire, not their entire, but big portions of the fortune they made in dot-coms to become governor of California. Why do they want to be governor of California so badly that they'll spend $25 million? I mean, they could have gone to space for that. You know, I'm among plenty of other things. So what is it that makes people do that? You know, from the outside, cynics will say, you know, maybe they think they can make even more money if they're governor of California than that $100 million, but that's pretty hard. You know, that's a lot of graft. So it seems to me that the basic idea is what you have an emotion. So what are emotions? Emotions, to me, are the reaction of your mind, your automatic mental reaction to what's going on in life. And there's a whole bunch of different emotions, but happiness is the one that we focus on. Aristotle, one of the reasons I find Epicurus fascinating and the Stoics as well is that they're both branches from Aristotelian and Platonic thought. I mean, they kind of take a piece of the action and they focus on it and they talk about it. And we talked at one of the other programs not too long ago about Machiavelli and how funny it is that Machiavelli, everything's called Machiavellian in politics, but Machiavelli was not as Machiavellian as most politicians. He was not Machiavellian himself. And Epicurus, as the saying, as you said, he's known for wine, women, and song, and that was not his life. So it's this reputational image, and we want to get past the image to the actual ideas that are behind it.
Well, he believed that there were three categories of desires.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
The one to be pursued, the group to be pursued were called natural and necessary desires. And those were the simplest to obtain. That was a roof over your head, simple fare, basic clothes, as you heard Alain de Botton say. Then you had natural but unnecessary. And there you move out, maybe instead of just having some jug wine, the wine gets better, the food gets better, you travel. The niceties of life, they don't cause you to go off the rails, but they are, if you were to go without, it wouldn't cause you pain per se. And then, of course, you have the unnatural and unnecessary, and this is the pursuit of power, this is vanity, this is overindulgence. He never quite worked out what to do about sex. Lucretius was a poet who lived just before Christ, lived about 150 years after Epicurus, who was one of his most important apostles, said that you really, because you get so undone by the passion of love versus, say, friendship, the circle of friends, that you really should seek out a random woman to have sex with. Now, that, of course, leads to other problems.
Problems, yes. All right. That's a nice breakdown of basically what are all material desires. And what fascinates me is that in developing any kind of philosophy and to try to explain happiness, it is really an explanation of the enthusiasms of the thinker for different forms of desire, of material desires, which they have found successful or unsuccessful. And therefore, they present it as this is what you should do. I mean, Hugh Hefner's approach is, also would be considered Epicurean by a lot of people for the wrong reason. But he stands as an example of just pursuing lust in life, essentially. And, he's fairly harmless, which is interesting because lust has been this demonic image for a long time. But it is a fairly harmless image that Hugh Hefner presents to the world. There's plenty of problem, but if you get involved with Hugh Hefner's group at any time in the last 50 years, you knew what you were expecting, and therefore you went into it with your eyes open.
Are you talking about the Playboy philosophy?
Yeah,
are you talking about Hugh Hefner? Well, the Playboy philosophy can be viewed as very damaging.
Yeah,
for all sorts of reasons.
Damaging, but if you accept that, compared to other things, so it's how much damage is there for other things? But let me go at this from a slightly different point of view. If your happiness is just an emotion, it's just in your own mind, which is what all emotions are, then the explanation, the analysis, shouldn't be sort of a category of desires that any one individual finds successful or not successful, but an actual analysis of our emotions and how we experience life, how we get happiness, how other people get happiness, and why we choose what we choose. And I would suggest that a different format for those motives or those desires or a different way of analyzing them would make it clear what's going on in our lives. And the format or the qualities are, first of all, your desires, all the desires that you listed in all three categories, are motivated by different motives. People have a wide variety of motives for sex, for example. But it's those motives which are the real desires. The thing that sits at the top is just the tip of the iceberg, as they say, or the top of the pyramid. What you really have is maybe 100 different motives for doing it, some of which conflict with each other, right? Because you want, one of my examples is you want the Mercedes. You want a Mercedes because you've got an old Datsun, and it's really getting old, and all your neighbors are kind of, you know, look at you as you go by. So you want to get a Mercedes, and some uncle calls you up and says, I'm going to buy you a Mercedes, and you're absolutely delighted. You go pick up the Mercedes, and you're driving it home, and you go by down your street, and as you're going down your street, you see that one of your neighbors has a BMW in the driveway, and the neighbor comes out and says, oh, why did you buy that? And how much of your happiness has just been taken away? And why? Because your motive wasn't just to have the Mercedes. Your motive was to have the Mercedes so that your neighbors would do something. You want to ask a question right away?
Yes.
Okay.
But that's why you're advised to just dispense with the Mercedes altogether and not try to keep up with the Joneses, because someone will always have a better car.
So far, is it working? So far, you've talked only about programmed material desires in a particular society. And I'm listening to you talking about sentient responses to your programming, not about the joy, the physical, the biochemical responses that all humans have, regardless of what society they're being programmed in. But right now, you're talking about happiness as being a response to gratification within a particular programming medium, rather than innate joy.
Okay.
I think he would say your presenter has to comment on that. There is certainly universals. If you're saying that we are, as human beings, moved by these sociobiological impulses and temperaments, and that, but people, of course, culturally find joy and pleasure in different contexts in different ways. But what Epicurus would say is if you took those particulars and just boiled them down to the basics, that if you can just, and in some ways, as I think you said, that it's, or someone said, that it's a kind of Buddhistic view of the world, that if you can achieve a simplicity and exclude all those Mercedes out there and you know, smell the roses, I suppose, in a way, in the garden, in your Epicurean garden, you're going to be far happier and wiser for that. So Candide, after Candide strolled around the world, came back and tended to his garden, because it's a waste of time. And just one other point. We've all been reading about these studies on happiness having to do with age. And I'm sure some of you saw this, that it was like a youth. So when you're 18, you're quite happy. And as you move past 20, your happiness quotient tends to go down and your sadness and anger quotient goes up until you're 50. And then it bottoms out, and then you start getting happier until you're 85. And I think you're happiest of all at 85 until you get so infirm, because you've let things go. You're no longer comparing yourself to the GS8 who's up here, or the assistant vice president versus the vice president. It's why Denmark is so happy. They have the garbage man and the young aristocrat who's practicing carpentry really existing in the same level, which, you know, in the US of A, is difficult to pull off. Yeah.
Can you elaborate on number 7, avoid risk? Whatever happened to seize the day, carpe diem?
Well, this is controversial, because when you avoid risk, because it will get in the way of achieving ataraxia, tranquility, but it also will eliminate pursuing excellence and pursuing mastery. One of the knocks on Epicureanism is that you mellow out, you go with the flow, but you cease trying to accomplish something, because that is risk. So when you do that, what have you given up? Particularly, what have you given up for your friends? If life becomes so simple, and you cease to master the piano or a particular craft, which doesn't seem to be fit into Epicurus' system, where it does fit into Aristotle's system, what have you eliminated or lost? You wanted to say something.
Mr. Merle, one of the most elusive things that we know is the pursuit of happiness, or for that extent, of truth. You have exhibited in here a video in which we have ample examples of organized happiness, such as the Kingdom of Denmark. Now, if we take this comparison of Denmark with happiness, and we see the bloody mess in which Greece is today, what do you think Epicurus would have to tell to the modern Greeks?
Well, he's rolled over in his grave a few times on modern Greece. You know, Greece at the time, as we were saying, was in tremendous turmoil. And there was not only fighting, but there was a lot of, graft and corruption. And, of course, now Greece holds the title for graft and corruption. But he was saying, let's escape. Let's find pockets of tranquility away from that. What he would say to the Greeks is that you've led a life of indolence, of trying to get something on the cheap, of retiring early, of paying someone to get the contract, and look what they're left with. They're left with a society that's bankrupt and probably very unhappy. Whereas so you look at the security of Denmark. And by the way, Denmark is not just a safe, organized society where the baby buggies can be outside the restaurant. This is Denmark where you had the cartoons of Allah and how that was pretty risky. None of the U.S. wouldn't do that. None of the U.S. papers. Now, you could argue whether that was prudent or not. But you could have that kind of... And let me also say that in Denmark, the cost of the public programs is 26% of GNP. And it's 44% of GNP in the U.S. And we don't begin to approach the kind of subsidization of education and health. You know, we think of the Scandinavian countries as yes, they're paying high taxes, but it, as a percentage of the GNP, it's rather low.
I think, as an example, it's useful to understand that it's 5.5 million instead of 300 million and a homogenous society. I think if people, those of us of a certain age, go back to the small towns of America when we were growing up, there was a sort of, everyone had the sort of same idea about how things should run, and all kinds of things were done that are against the law now. But everybody kind of looked out over things because it was more of a homogenous community. We do have to kind of figure out how to do it in a more heterogeneous community, because that's the future. Let's keep going with the questions, but the basic idea I wanted to put forward before is, in the simplification, it seems to me that the simplification is done by external desires, whereas the real simplification should be done in terms of the clarity of your motives and your emotions and why you do things. And if you simplify, you can go after big projects. For example, if you go after a big project, but it's only 1% of the overall idea about where you think your happiness is going to come from, and you do it in a contingent way, then you can do it without it overwhelming you. But that's for another time. Questions?
Quite a few years back, I'll date myself, but when John Kennedy was having a press conference and somebody asked him whether he was happy, and he said, well, yes, if you define it as the Greeks define it, which is the full use of your powers along the lines of excellence. And I never understood that until I started teaching, and I teach art in grade school. And the first time that happened was when a class really, really worked. I mean, it was the most phenomenal feeling I'd ever had. And I think that's what happiness is.
Well, there's the dilemma, because you as a teacher knew you had goals that you set for having an excellent class. Yes, and when everything worked, everything clicked, you had achieved a kind of excellence as a teacher. And I'm saying that the Epicurean approach doesn't leave a lot of room for excelling, because to excel or to attempt to excel is to have to eliminate so much of life. You have to just put on the blinders and go for it. And that doesn't seem to work for Epicureanism. Epicureans tend to be a little more eclectic. They're more curious about the larger world. And it's the very rare person, George Hammond being one, that can pursue wisdom and meaning and knowledge and still have a very fine career in international M&A as a lawyer. This is not easy to pull off, and I would like to acknowledge our moderator for doing this.
You mentioned a few times today about simplification, driving to what, you know, can bring you happiness. And I was just thinking, you know, it reminded me of an experience I had this last year where I had a cholesterol test done. And I always thought that one of my pure joys was chocolate and ice cream. You know, if you wanted to say, like, what's that simplification of simple pleasures? And magically coming, yeah, I would say within a week, I no longer liked ice cream and chocolate. I actually disliked their flavors and it made me, you know, ill. And I started thinking to myself, how much of what I think is, you know, happy making is really, I don't know, it's some combination of the brainwashing. I was, you know, just, I'm born into a culture, and I'm told these are my checklist of items, and I make up these narrations. And it just, so when I hear simplification, sometimes I'm just brought back to perhaps distillation, like, because now I'm sitting here thinking, like, it wasn't chocolate and ice cream. There's something deeper there. And I know I'm making up a narration, and I don't know what it is. I think it's food, good food, but, you know, that's where I'm left with it.
Well, again, as you heard, that Epicurus had little interest in, quote, fine food, gourmet food. He was a water and bread guy.
Right. And it is a very good point that, you know, it's what you kind of are told. What's your checklist, you know? Now the latest thing is your bucket list. Before you die, you need to finish off all these things. As if without it, you can't be happy. But, of course, it's not those things. It's why do you want those things? What is your motive for those things? And that really is 99% of all your desires are the motives that are underneath it, as you say.
And I would say happiness is being content with what you have and not wanting things which you know before. You cannot have them. That's my personal opinion.
No, and that's what you heard on the video, that those young Danes, yes, no, they said contented, being content with what you have. No, I'm saying that you are a fine Epicurean, madam.
I think one of the things in my analysis about the motives is that the worst set of desires, I divide it up by independence and productivity versus destructive. So the highest quality of desires are independent, productive desires. That is, you can fulfill them yourself, because fulfilling is really crucial. The next ones are dependent, productive desires. They're dependent on external things, and they're dependent on other people. So it's not totally within your control, but you still can get a lot of quality. Then there's neutral dependent, and there's destructive dependent, and then there's impossible desires. And those things that are impossible, in spite of the impossible dream and how it inspires people, if it really and truly is impossible, you can never fulfill it. It can only be frustrating. And so at a certain point, I think, and your chart shows that on the age, at a certain point, people start to put off not what are technically, logically impossible, but are no longer on their list, no longer likely to be fulfilled. They start dropping off and they start becoming happier, I think.
Well, I thought that's why that one quote from the young man who said about the American dream, forget it. It's not going to happen. And if people could lower those expectations, be content with what they have, they would be happier.
Yeah, I have a couple comments and a good question. But the comments are, I watched Joel Osteen on the morning on Sunday, and he's terrific. And he said, to be happy and contented, you got to pursue something in life. And he wants you to go after your goals, and he wants you to meet new people, not just be with the same old people you're used to. And also, I took several courses on happiness, and the bottom line, what they all say, is gratitude, something that George mentioned. You got to be happy where you're at. And the question is, where you started off, you said Epicurus said the best thing is to give yourself time to analyze your life, something that you mentioned. How did he do it?
Well, Epicurus had the luxury of leaving Athens and going to the garden and having a group of friends, many of whom supported the garden lifestyle. So it does require, I guess, the luxury of time and the freedom to pursue meaning. And you can't be working on projects for work to bring home bread for the family until 10 o'clock at night and hope to have time to pursue meaning, which will then cause you to be less confused about the world. It's an unfortunate fact of life, really.
Not between 10 p.m. and 11 p.m. every evening.
That's about it.
Okay, there's time for...
Well, he actually wrote 300 books. Very little of it has survived. And let me recommend that for those who want to get down into the specifics of what we know about Epicurus, there's a wonderful website called epicurus.info. And it has all the few sayings that we have left from Epicurus, plus a lot of commentary. And with an hour, we can only do so much.
Just scratch. Now, unfortunately, the hour is up. We have time for one more question. Anybody that would like to ask other questions, Tom, you'll stay after.
Well, and also I was going to recommend that those who have more time, we can go down and have some Japanese food just a block and a half down and do what we used to do.
My comment is the other comment about the unexamined life is not worth living, and I find lots of time to do it. Walking along, taking the BART, walking down the street, waiting for the doctor. I use a journal. I do reflective thinking, introspection. There's many ways.
But the test there is not that you should examine life because it makes life more worth living, is that you will reduce the confusion and the ignorance that causes us distress. So you've got to pursue this meaning.
Okay. Thank you very much, Tom. It was a great intro to the episode. And now this session of the Commonwealth Club of California in its 107th year of enlightened discussion has come to an end. Yeah.